want you to turn back in your notes to Hosea 4:3. Turn back to Hosea 4:3. And this review comes to you by way of John. John brought up raise your hand, John. John brought up a question, and in answering the question, I had to go back to Isaiah 4:3 and take a closer look at that verse, and it was very, very well worth it. Isaiah 4:3, everybody there? Hosea 4:3, did I say Isaiah? Hosea 4:3 talks about the land mourning, everyone who living in it languishing, along with the beasts of the field, the birds of the sky, and the fish of the sea disappearing. So it's a time of judgment, and I just I didn't spend much time on that verse. I just said even the environment is affected by the sin here. But looking more a little closer at that verse, we see that it's talking about a drought. It's a drought so severe that it affects all human, plant, animal, bird, and even aquatic life. And so it seems, as we look at that drought, two ideas seem to be possible there. First of all, the rivers and the streams could be so dried up because of the drought that if there are, I don't know what the how many spawning fish you have in Israel, but it could be that the streams and rivers are so dried up that the fish can't come upstream to spawn. Or something hit me that was even more reasonable, that the Sea of Galilee is so low that it had become polluted. Now this almost happened last year, didn't it? They were sweating it out as the Sea of Galilee was about 30 feet below normal. See, the problem with the Sea of Galilee is it sits over some underground springs that are not fresh water. They're polluted. They're kind of like salt water, and it's the weight of the Sea of Galilee pressing down on the springs that keep them from gushing up. And as the Sea of Galilee reduces, evaporates, well, the weight of the water is less, and finally it gets to the point where those underground springs will spring up and will pollute the Sea of Galilee. That's the problem with the water level there. So if we had a very, very severe drought that was even worse than last year, that could very well happen, and the freshwater fish in the Sea of Galilee would die. That was the concern. So I think as I look at chapter 4, verse 3 a little closer, I think that's the best position, because drought is one of the curses of the Mosaic Covenant. Leviticus 26:19, Deuteronomy 28:23, and 24. Leviticus 26:19, Deuteronomy 28:23, and 24. That's one of the curses of the Mosaic Covenant. And we know from our study that the Northern Kingdom has been blatantly sinning, and God has been dealing with the Northern Kingdom. And he does give this prediction here of a very, very severe drought. And I think it comes up over and over again. That's why I'm going back to it. You'll see it start to come up over and over again, because we're going to be back in our time frame to Hosea's day again. So note that chapter 4, verse 3 is a very, very severe drought that's happening in Hosea's time. So we finished up in chapter 4 last week. We jumped into chapter 5, and when we jumped into chapter 5, we jumped into the tribulation period, and we will be in that time until we get to verse 11 of chapter 6. We got to verse 3 of chapter 6 last week. Then we're going to jump back in chapter 7 to Hosea's time frame, and then in chapters 8 through 10 to the Assyrian judgment of 122 B.C. As you can see, I'm adding to our time frames chart, and when I get it done, you'll get a copy of it. So you'll be able to see how Hosea jumps back and forth along the time frame and where his key concerns lie. Okay, was that clear, my little review and going back over 4:3? Thank you, John, for bringing up the question and for forcing me to go back and look at that verse a little more in depth. Okay, let's pick it up now in Hosea chapter 6, verse 4. We have seen in chapter 6, verses 1 through 3. Excuse me, let's back up to chapter 5, the last verse of chapter 5 in the English, verse 15. The God says he will go away and return to his place until they acknowledge their guilt and seek my face. In their affliction, they will earnestly seek me. And remember, I feel that is a reference to God becoming incarnate as a man, a very unique situation, quote, leaving heaven, so to speak, and then a singular sin is committed against him, the rejection of the Messiahship of Yeshua, and he returns to heaven at the ascension, and he will not return until we cry, Baruch Haba B'Shem Adonai, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, Psalm 118:26, the great messianic greeting. And then in verses 1 through 3 of chapter 6, we saw that Israel in the tribulation, the leadership issues a decree to seek the Lord. The nation responds to that decree and in faith and in confidence seek out and call for the Messiah to return. And of course, that's the last 3 days of the tribulation. We develop that a little bit more, then I'll develop it in the review here. And Yeshua will return then at the end of the tribulation period. Now, as we get into chapter 6, verse 4, God continues his criticism of the entire nation. Remember, this dealt with these judgments in chapter 5 and chapter 6 dealt with the entire nation, Ephraim and Judah, Israel and Judah. It wasn't focused strictly on the northern kingdom. And so I felt that this speaks of the entire nation, a time when the entire nation comes under judgment. And of course, that did not happen until the Roman destruction in 70 AD. So it happened during the Lo Ami period, and the Lo Ami period will find its end at the end of the tribulation. So God continues to call his people to account, both Judah and Ephraim, Judah and Ephraim, Judah and Israel, in chapter 6, starting in verse 4. He starts, and we're on page 33 of your notes. On page 33, he talks about the broken covenant. Now, does anyone want to pick up a note, the notes at all? Everybody got it here? Okay. He talks about the broken covenant. And he begins in verse 4 by talking about insincerity on the part of Israel and Judah. Verse 4. What shall I do to you, O Ephraim? What shall I do with you, O Judah? Your loyalty is like a morning cloud and the dew which goes away early. So point one, you see that a comparison there, a word picture is made between Israel's loyalty and the dew and the morning cloud. And the idea here is, point two, that it's very transitory. The nation's loyalty is nothing but an insincere pretext. It's quickly gone. It evaporates, like with the morning sun, like our Southern California marine layer here. It's pretty thick at 6 in the morning, but by 8, 9, 10, it's gone. So is the nation's loyalty. The result is in verse 5, therefore I have hewn them in pieces by the prophets, I have slain them by the words of my mouth, and the judgments on you are like the light that goes forth. So the judgments that God has predicted through his prophets will bring severe discipline upon the nation. That's the result. The words of the prophets, the predictions by the prophets, including Hosea's here, will bring judgment on the nation. And the reason for the judgment, verse 6, lack of knowledge. For I delight in loyalty rather than sacrifice, in the knowledge of God rather than burnt offering. Now your notes there says goodness. The Hebrew word there is chesed, which span that word in italics, goodness. Chesed, it's loyalty or loyal love or kindness. Most Hebrew words have a very broad range of meaning. And so goodness is a fine translation, but there's other ideas behind that word too. So chesed must precede sacrifice. And then point two, a parallel statement, knowledge of God, must precede burnt offerings. And this is typical Hebraic writing. Goodness and knowledge of God go hand in hand there. Sacrifice and burnt offering go hand in hand there. Two parallel statements. And God is not denigrating the sacrificial system. He's not saying that Israel must not participate in the sacrificial system. He's just setting the proper priorities here. You see, faith must precede the sacrifice. the relationship, the personal relationship with God must come first. Then the expression of that personal relationship. That comes next. So the personal relationship with God first, the loyalty to God, the knowledge of God, that must come first. Then you express that knowledge, you express that loyalty, that goodness, by offering, by participating in the sacrificial system. And that's no different than we have today. The faithful Jewish person in Hosea's day expressed his obedience and his love for God through the sacrificial system. Today, we express our commitment and our walk with Yeshua through the commands of the New Covenant, through the law of the Messiah. There's over 600 commands in the New Testament that we're supposed to follow. And they don't come across as commands in the English. If you look at them in the Greek, and they're commands. So we're to obey the Lord today and express that's the content of our faith today, following the instructions of the New Covenant. Question? Yeah, that's what our works are, sure. Yeah, our works are to be an expression of our love and loyalty to God. And so the believer during the Old Testament times does exactly what we did today, except their content's a little different. Their content of faith then was the Old Testament. Our content of faith today is the New Testament or the New Covenant. Okay, in verse 7, we see that treachery is afoot. Verse 7, "But like Adam, they have transgressed the covenant. They have dealt treacherously against me." Point 1 there in your outline, it says Adam broke the Edenic covenant. Now, we don't see a real formal covenant form in Eden, but God calls it a covenant here, so apparently there was a covenant God made with Adam in Eden, and that's in Genesis 1:28-30, Genesis 1:28-30, and Genesis 2:15-17. That would be the Edenic covenant, the covenant in Eden. Genesis 1:28-30 and 2:15-17. So just as Adam broke the covenant in Eden, so Israel breaks the Mosaic covenant, or has broken the Mosaic covenant. And that's very clearly stated in Jeremiah 31:31 and following. God says there that we broke the covenant he made with us at Sinai. So there's the treachery, the breaking of a covenant, treachery against God. Israel has done just what Adam did. And then in point E, he talks about the geography of wickedness. He mentions Gilead first in verse 8. Gilead is a city of wrongdoers, tracked with bloody footprints. Now, Gilead was a region, a district, actually, on the east side of the Jordan River. You see that on this map. Of course, I'm not going to give you this map because you probably will have them in your Bibles. He calls Gilead a city of wrongdoers. Well, we don't know of a formal city named Gilead in that area. There may be. Some commentators think a city is in view from Genesis 31. Judges, did you guys want these verses at all? And Judges 10:17 and 12:7. Some commentators think that a possible city named Gilead is in view. Genesis 31:47 and 48. And Judges 10:17 through 12:7. And that's a possibility because Hosea was familiar, of course, with the territory, but this is the area that he's talking about. We're talking about the east side of the Jordan. He may be viewing the territory of Gilead as a unit, and therefore calling it a city. He's possibly doing that. A city that's united in wickedness, a territory united in wickedness. But whatever way we go, we're going to see that both sides of the Jordan, east and west, that's verse 9, is Shechem. Go to verse 9. "And as a man, and as raiders wait for a man, a band of priests murder on their way to Shechem. Surely they have committed a crime." And Shechem was in this area. I don't have it. It's not on this particular map, but it was in this particular area. So the point is that east of the Jordan, west of the Jordan, the northern kingdom, all of it, is caught up in sin. Caught up in sin. Now on page 34 there, on verse 9 there, you see that point B, that Shechem was a Levitical city in Joshua 21:21. See, the Levites did not receive territory of their own. They received cities in which they lived, and from those cities they were supposed to teach the nation. So Shechem was supposed to be a Levitical city, a strong point of knowledge of God and biblical teaching. It was also a city of refuge in Joshua 20, verse 7. That meant it was a sanctuary for someone who committed unintentional homicide. If you accidentally killed another person, you could flee to a city of refuge for safety. You would be safe from the nearest of kin, who would be the avenger of blood. So you had a city of refuge to flee through. But point D, now, it's not a sanctuary for those who have accidentally killed somebody. It's not a place of teaching. It's a sanctuary for murderers, deliberate killers, and not just ordinary murderers. Point E, band of priests wander around the highways killing. So there's Levites involved in this criminal activity. And so the situation is pretty bad when the religious leadership is ungodly. Then he turns his attention to what he calls the house of Israel in verse 10. In the house of Israel, I've seen a horrible thing. Ephraim's harlotry is there. Israel has defiled itself. Now on your notes, point A says whoredom. Literally, the NASB has done a better job there. Horrible thing, I think, would be a better translation there. Literally, a horrible thing. So you could write horrible thing next to whoredom to kind of expand what he's talking about there. In the Sanchino books of the Bible, a classic Jewish commentary, the rabbi makes this statement about the word horrible thing. He said the word expresses what is horrifying and makes the hair stand up on end. Okay, you know, it just makes you shudder, and you get a view of God's emotions here. In his view, what's happening in Israel is a horrible thing. It's, if you feel the hair stand up on the back of your head and you shudder, that's the way God reacts to it. This defilement. And please don't get emotions backwards. We are built in the image of God. These emotions that God feels, we're supposed to feel because we're reflecting him. It's not that we feel it and then he's trying to identify with us. It's the other way around. We're built in his image. This is the way he is, and we reflect him. So don't get it backwards. A lot of people get it backwards by saying anthropomorphisms, that God talks in human terms so that we can understand God. Well, actually, we are built in the image of God. So, first of all, look at it that way. The way he is the we should understand the way he is because we're built in his image. So anyway, he gives us a word picture there that we ought to understand. The way he feels about that horrible thing, we should feel about it. Verse 11, he gives a little aside to Judah. Remember, he's finishing up with the whole nation here. I think he's talking about the end of the Lo Ami period. In verse 11, he says, "Also, O Judah, there's a harvest appointed for you when I restore the fortunes of my people." So the northern kingdom is not the only one singled out for judgment. And I think the point on the point B there, before the captivity comes, I'm doing a bit of correcting, I feel, on some of your notes here. Now, I respect Ariel Ministries tremendously and Dr. Fruchtenbaum, but I think he's missed a few points here. I think that the comment before the captivity comes is not right on base. I think what he's talking about here is that there's going to be tribulation and judgment prior to the establishment of the Messianic Kingdom, and that Judah is not going to get away scot-free either. Just a little warning that when I restore the fortunes of my people, there's going to be a calling to account. A calling to account. And that's part of the reason for the tribulation, is to weed out from the nation those who are the evil and evildoers. So there's going to be a calling to account for you, Judah, as well, before I begin the Messianic Kingdom. Now, I don't know how your Bibles handle the last part of verse 11. If you have an NIV, they take a minority position and they attach the phrase, "When I restore the fortunes of my people," to chapter 7, verse 1. That's a minority position. Most translators attach it as the way the NASB does, the last phrase of verse 11. When I restore the fortunes of my people, it's attached there to verse 11. So you might see a little difference there if you have an NIV. But I think the NASB has done the better position, done the better break. Okay. Questions? Anything there? All right. Let's think about some thoughts of application at this point in time. Let's see. Hosea 5:1 to 6:11. Let me pass out a little application chart. And let's see how we can apply this to our lives today. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on thoughts of application this morning because I want to move through Hosea. Okay, everybody have one? Is it working to put the notes on different colors? That you like that? Everybody's happy with that. Okay. You guys have won again. All right, Hosea 5:1 through 6:11, an application chart here. As we have gone through those two chapters, I felt a good theme that came out of that is Israel's backsliding and inability to repent. And where did I get that? Under the words application. Israel was very religious. They practiced all kinds of religious observances, but they didn't know God. And this will continue until Israel earnestly seeks God. Then God will heal the nation. See, it's happening today. This describes the Jewish community both in Israel and in the diaspora today. In fact, those who are religious only comprise about 10% of the nation. And they are missing the point by focusing in on rabbinic Judaism and not in on the Messiah. Oh, you're correct, yeah. So, specific application for us today. Do we do the same thing? Are you playing church or playing religion and not earnestly seeking God? And you know, a lot of people in synagogues and churches go on Saturday or Sunday for what? For business contacts, things like that. You know, or they go have a good time to be entertained. I think a lot of churches, unfortunately, and I've seen a lot of it in Southern California, not so much up when we lived up in Seattle and Portland, but there's a draw into a lot of churches, and it's not to worship God. It's more like, well, you have needs, and so you come to our church, and we'll feel good, and we'll sing nice songs, and you will feel really good, and you'll be uplifted. When what's the purpose for gathering together? Our purpose is to worship the Lord. Okay, that's our... Now, if we feel good when we're worshiping the Lord, that's great. If we dance when we worship the Lord, that's great. But the attitude has to be, we're here to give praise and honor to God and to gain knowledge of Him through the study of His Word, to worship Him first. That's where our priority should be. So, we can play church. We can play religion today as well. Plan of action. If this application in any way touches your heart personally, perhaps there's something you could write down there to not play the game and to instead earnestly seek the Lord in worship and in knowledge of Him. That begins with intellectual knowledge of His Word, and then it works itself out in experiential knowledge as we obey His Word. Okay. Shall we move on? Let's move on to chapter 7 of Hosea. In chapter 7 of Hosea, I feel we now bounce back. We're up here at the end of the tribulation period. Now we bounce back along the timeline to approximately 781 B.C. When Hosea began his ministry. And I think pathetic present condition of Israel in Hosea's day. Israel's pathetic present condition. Okay, point, verse 30, chapter, I'll get it, page 34. Toward the bottom of the page, we're at point 2, Israel's domestic, fatal domestic policy. In verses 1 through 7, and we see that their domestic policy is fatally sick, has a cancer in it, in verse 1. When I would heal Israel, the iniquity of Ephraim is uncovered, and the evil deeds of Samaria, for they deal falsely. The thief enters in, bandits raid outside. See, every time God moves to heal Israel's sickness, every time God moves to heal her disease, more is uncovered. So there's disease within and without. It's like trying to cut out a cancer and finding, oops, I didn't go deep enough. Oops, I didn't go deep enough. Oops, I didn't go deep enough. It's an incurable illness. Falsehood within, bands of robbers without. It's especially incurable if those bands of robbers include priests. Remember, we looked at that criticism a couple of times. Priests are part of this sickness, this cancer. And God is very aware of this in verse 2. And they do not consider in their hearts, they do not consider in their hearts that I remember all their wickedness. Now their deeds are all around them. They are before my face. So points 1 and 2 are well taken. God takes note of every sin, and it's their sins that will destroy them. Yet they're just ignorant of it. It's like a person who's ignoring the symptoms of cancer. They don't want to go to the doctor. They don't want to go and get it dealt with. In fact, they kind of like it. Okay, page 35. Page 35. We see the sickness. We see that God is very aware of the sickness. And then in verses 3 through 7, he deals with a key problem, which were constant conspiracies for the throne. There's conspiracies within. Remember, this is the sick domestic policy. There's constant conspiracies for the throne. There were 19 kings of the northern kingdom. 19 kings. All were bad. 7 were assassinated. So it was a turbulent time, especially Hosea's time toward the end of the northern kingdom. We'll see that as we get down to verse 7. Okay, so we take a look at this conspiracy in verse 3. With their wickedness, they make the king glad, and the princes with their lies. So they lull the king and his guards to sleep with their lies. They claim loyalty to the king, and so he's taken in by the lies. And so he relaxes his guard. Something Saddam Hussein never did he? He never trusted anybody. Well, this king makes the mistake of listening to these lies, so he relaxes his guard. And then in verse 4, God brings out word picture here. The conspiracy is like a kindled oven. First, like an oven heated by a baker who ceases to stir up the fire from the kneading of the dough until it is leavened. So you see point A there. The picture is an oven kindled at night, and it's so hot, the baker has gotten it so hot that it's left alone. It's left alone through the night in order to cool down. And the dough, which is going to become bread in the morning, is allowed to leaven. And so point C, in like manner, The conspiracy is allowed to develop over the course of time. It gets white hot. It gets very hot. It's just waiting for the proper moment. And it breaks forth in verse 5. On the day of our king, the princes become sick with the heat of wine. He stretched out his hand with scoffers. Point A there, on the day of our king, that's either the king's birthday or some anniversary, perhaps of his coronation. But the point is, whatever this day of our king is, it's an excuse for a big party. Lots of feasting, lots of drinking, right? And so point B, the princes are sick on the wine they've consumed so much. It's kind of a gross scene there. I'm not going to develop it anymore. They're all sick of the wine. And the king himself has joined them. He's reached out for strong drink. Okay, he's joined the scoffers. So the king and the princes are inebriated as well. They're all plastered, and now the conspirators act. In verse 6, for their hearts are like an oven. As they approach their plotting, their anger smolders all night. In the morning, it burns like a flaming fire. So we're developing that picture of the baker heating the oven. In the morning, the baker awakes. Point A there. The dough's leavened. The oven is cooled down, so he stokes up the coals to make sure it's at the proper heat, and it's ready for baking, and in goes the bread. Well, that's what happens with the conspiracy as well. It's ready. It's time to act. The conspiracy comes to fruition, the hot conspiracy, and so the assassination of the king is brought out in verse 7. All of them are hot like an oven. They consume their rulers. All of their kings have fallen. None of them calls on me. And you see point A in your notes there. The kings have fallen. Four of the last six kings are assassinated. And so it was a turbulent time toward the end of the northern kingdom. You see them listed there and the cross references that refer to their assassination. But point B is the most important. None inquired of the Lord regarding the right of a particular king to reign. There were a number of dynastic changes in Israel's history, as you can tell. But they were not brought about by the Lord. You see, there were two key requirements for assuming legitimate leadership of the northern kingdom. And I don't know if you've got room at the bottom of your page. You might want to put this information perhaps in that block next to the four kings there. But there were two requirements for assuming legitimate leadership of the northern kingdom. Number one was prophetic sanction, and number two was divine appointment. Prophetic sanction and divine appointment, they had to go together. God had to tell his prophet, I want such and such a person to be king. The prophet would then announce that to the new king in some manner. Anyone who did not follow or did not have these two conditions met was assassinated. And since no one in the northern kingdom was looking to God for direction, the conspiracies continued one after another. So God allowed the illegitimate kings to remove themselves. He just kind of allowed the normal sequence of ungodly events to play themselves out. And so Israel's domestic policy of a conquest. So a domestic, fatal domestic policy that put the nation in turmoil, weakened her politically. The leadership was a mess. She was ripe for judgment from the outside. And as we turn to page 36, we now look at that disastrous foreign policy. We look at what's happening outside. Point three at the top of page 36, Israel's disastrous foreign policy. And the nation is illustrated under three symbols here. First one, point A in your notes, Ephraim is a cake not turned. Let's go to verse 8 as we develop this picture that God gives us. Ephraim, verse 8. Ephraim mixes himself with the nations. Ephraim has become a cake not turned. So mixing among the nations, she's adopted the heathen ways. She's failed in point B to be separate. Exodus 34, verses 12 through 16, demanded that Israel be a separate, distinct nation. In fact, we were to be the happiest, healthiest, most stable, prosperous nation on the face of the earth if we obey the Torah, if we obey the Mosaic Law. God promises that blessings would shower down upon the nation. Israel would stand out as a nation of priests, a holy nation. We would have been a guiding light to the world. But we weren't separate. We didn't follow the Mosaic Law. And the result, point C, a cake not turned. That's a reference to something that's burned on the bottom and doughy on top. Now, usually on Saturday mornings, I get up and I fix my wife breakfast in bed. Now, I don't cook, you guys. I hate cooking, okay? Now, if I took a pancake and mixed up pancake dough and threw it on a griddle, it would probably end up looking like this. It would probably be burned on the bottom and soft on the top, right? Now, can you imagine me serving that up to my wife? Here, honey, here, Susan, here's your breakfast in bed. That would be repulsive, wouldn't it? I don't think she'd eat it. I hope not. And that's the picture here. This thing is repulsive. Cereal. Oatmeal, cold cereal, and I can do omelets there. I hate it though. I just don't like to cook. Do I have a chart on that? No, I'm not going to do it. Forget it. No, I hate cooking, you guys. I don't mind taking something out of the freezer and sticking it in the microwave. I don't mind that at all. But man, all the rest of that stuff. Okay, I'm glad for you wives. I'm glad for my wife. Okay, so Israel is half-baked. She's like the half-baked pancake. Burned to a crisp on the bottom, doughy on top. And the Sanchino books of the Bible had an interesting comment I thought I'd like to share with you. The rabbi says this, quote, "How better describe a half-cultured society, a half-lived religion, a half-hearted policy?" I thought that was a nice description. How better to describe a half-cultured society, a half-lived religion, a half-hearted policy? Kind of reminds me of the book of Revelation, right? Where God says, I'd rather have you hot or cold, but I don't want you lukewarm. And that's the way this cake is. It's, I'd rather have you uncooked or burned, but not both. Okay. Repulsive. Ephraim is repulsive for living 1 foot in the kingdom and 1 foot in the world. And boy, we can do the same thing, can't we? A lot of people try to do that. We try to live 1 foot in God's kingdom and 1 foot in the world, and it just doesn't work, folks. Make up your mind one way or the other. David. Say again? Well, you can't serve God and mammon. You can't serve the world and you can't serve God. Yes, Yeshua said that. You can't serve God and mammon. Mammon is a Hebraic term, a rabbinic term for anything that the world offers, mammon. You can't serve God and mammon. You got to make your choice. Otherwise, you're like this pancake that I cook, okay? You're repulsive. So next time you see a burned pancake, it'll have a spiritual lesson. In fact, you can do that with your kids, you guys. You know, spiritual lesson. Here, okay. Good application. All right, let's move on. Verse 9. You see in point 2 that the strength of Israel is ebb, but he doesn't know it. Verse 9. Strangers devour his strength, yet he does not know it. Gray hairs are also sprinkled on him, yet he does not know it. So the northern kingdom is now pictured as an old man. He's unaware of his infirm condition. He's got gray hair, but he can't see it, right? I can't see my hair. I can't see my bald spot, can you? You guys can. I can't see my gray hair. Man, I'm still 20. Okay? That's the way the guy's acting here. Israel's going through a midlife crisis. They don't know how weak they are. They can't see it. The Sanchino commentary also had a humorous remark, I thought. The rabbi brings out the point that Jewish commentators liken gray hair to rust. Now, that's not necessarily negative. That's not necessarily negative, you guys, because it's just a recognition that as something gets old and used, it gets rusty. It doesn't mean it gets dishonored. Okay, that shovel you bought used to be, when you got it at Home Depot, was nice and pretty, and now it's all rusted because you've used it to dig a couple of ditches. Well, that's the way we are. We get old and we get rusty on top, not necessarily dishonored. Okay, so I'm rusty, you guys, or I'm getting there. Okay, God testifies to Israel's face, and there's no response. Verse 10, someone's going to tell them about the problem that they're not seeing. They're not seeing this weakness, this compromise, this repulsiveness. Somebody's going to tell them in verse 10. Though the pride of Israel testifies against him, yet they have neither returned to the Lord their God, nor have they sought him for all this. So there's no response, no return, no seeking. This is the exact same expression we saw in chapter 5, verse 5. Remember chapter 5, verse 5, we saw Ge'on Yisrael, and we had an alternate rendering. It either is pride in the negative sense, arrogance, or it can refer to pride in the positive sense. In that sense, it would refer to God. So either Israel's pride in the positive sense, God himself testifies against Israel, or it is pride in the negative sense, Israel's arrogance testifies against her. But the point is, Israel has somebody telling her that something is wrong in this courtroom kind of scene, and she doesn't respond. Her face is just blank. There's no seeking, no return, even though evidence is coming forward, either from her own actions or from God himself. So that's the first picture. Ephraim, a cake not turned. Point B, Ephraim is like a silly dove in verses 11 and 12. Verse 11. So Ephraim has become like a silly dove without sense. They call to Egypt. They go to Assyria. So the picture here is this bird, this dove, in panic, trying to escape some danger. So she's fluttering back and forth between Egypt and Assyria. She doesn't know which one to join. First go here, first go there. So she's easily seduced. She's like a dove that's easily lured by food into a snare. She's incredibly vulnerable because she has no convictions, doesn't know where to go. And so she's caught in verse 12. When they go, I will spread my net over them. I will bring them down like the birds of the sky. I will chastise them in accordance with the proclamation to their assembly. So here God is pictured as a fowler. He's throwing his net. He's a fowler. He's hunting birds. He's throwing his net over this silly dove. And he's catching her, bringing her down, hemming her in. So Israel is repulsive, like a cake not turned. She is like a silly dove. She's indecisive. Page 37. She's like a deceitful bow. Question? Yeah, exactly. Sure. She's been told. Israel's been told. Israel has that information. Point C, Ephraim is like a deceitful bow. Verse 13, woe to them, for they have strayed from me. Destruction is theirs, for they have rebelled against me. I would redeem them, but they speak lies against me. Point A there, woe, it's the Hebrew word oi. Okay, oi. Okay, woe, that's where you get oi vey, huh? It's woe. So Israel has wandered away. They will be destroyed. But God has a desire to redeem them, but it's frustrated by their lies in verse 13. I would redeem them, but they speak lies against me. And here again, we see that mystery. of God's omniscience and man's free will. God knows all that's going to happen. He's never caught by surprise. And yet men make responsible decisions. So it isn't as though God is powerless here. It isn't though he's caught by surprise. He's fully aware of all that's going to happen. But he's recognizing the fact that men make decisions, and the decision here is to lie to God. Now, can you imagine that? Lying to God? What does that speak of? That speaks of a very, very low view of God. A very low view of God. That he's not omniscient, that he's not omnipotent. Where does that come from? What's the problem we've been reading about in Hosea again and again? Lack of knowledge. There you go. Incorrect knowledge of God, and so they have a very, very low view of God, thinking they can hide something from him. Then we've seen that Ephraim is a deceitful bow, or we'll see that in just a moment. How is she a deceitful bow? First of all, she speaks lies to God, and secondly, her rebellion in verse 14. And they do not cry to me from their heart when they wail on their beds. For the sake of grain and new wine they assemble themselves, and they turn away from me. So even when they see destruction approaching, even when there's a tribulation in their lives, they don't return to God. When they wail, they don't look to him. You know, the picture here is a little kid, you know, wailing and running into daddy's arms. You know, that's what God wants us to do. It's okay to, for your like your grandchild, your son, to your little two-year-old to come screaming into your arms, you know, because they're hurt, they have an owie. Well, that's what God wanted Israel to do here. They do assemble. They do assemble, but it's not for worship. They just go to God for what they want, what they can get out of it. So they're not looking to him. They're turning away from him. They just are interested in the material aspect of life. And so Israel's treachery against God is brought out in verse 15 again. Although I trained and strengthened their arms, yet they devise evil against me. And you see point A and B, God taught them, God strengthened them, and yet they rebel. There's no appreciation, no gratitude, no thanksgiving for God's input into their lives. Just totally oblivious to all that God has done for them. And because of all this, because of the lies, because of the treachery, because of the rebellion, Israel can't hit the mark in verse 16. They turn, but not upward. They are like a deceitful bow. Their princes will fall by the sword because of the insolence of their tongue. This will be their derision in the land of Egypt. Faulty. Faulty. Okay. There's something wrong with it, and that the arrow doesn't fly straight. Okay. Question.
Verse 16, it says they returned. So they went back to something. Since it wasn't God, was it idolatry?
Right. Their aim is not God, but it's Egypt. They're flying back and forth between Egypt and Assyria. They're not looking to the Lord. Their aim isn't straight. Their aim is somewhere else. And because of this, their leaders will fall, and when they find themselves in Egypt, and we'll see that in just a little bit, they will experience humiliation. And we'll see that some of the northern kingdom is going to return to Egypt. Now, the basic Hebrew meaning, the basic Hebrew word for sin means to miss the mark. And that's the picture that we have before us here. Israel can't shoot straight. They miss the target. They're using a faulty bow. Question. No. I don't think they're intentionally. They're trying, but they're so warped by the lies, by the rebellion, by the treachery, that they can't shoot straight. They think they are, but they always miss the target. Okay, so the foreign policy was disastrous. They were a cake not turned. They were half-hearted. They were a silly dove. They were indecisive. They were a faulty bow, missing the mark. That's the disastrous foreign policy of the Northern Kingdom. And so now as we flow into chapter 8 on page 38, there's a call of a trumpet for judgment. This is the result of chapter 7. I won't get through chapter 10 today, but at least I'll get through, I think, 8, I hope. So this is the result of chapter 7. This is the result of a domestic policy and a foreign policy that are disastrous. 5 points. First of all, there's a call of trumpet, a call of the trumpet against covenant breakers. The call itself is in verse 1. Put the trumpet to your lips. Like an eagle, the enemy comes against the house of the Lord. So you have a figure of speech here as an eagle. It's a figure of speech for swiftness. And you see in point B there, it's against the house of the Lord. Now, it's probably a reference to the nation. Remember, this is referring to the Northern Kingdom, and there's no legitimate temple in the north that this could refer to. So this must not be a reference to the temple, but to the nation. There were a number of false temples up north, but not the true one. That was down south in Jerusalem. And I think we can call the nation the house of Jehovah, because positionally, Israel is always God's people. Positionally, we always are. But experientially, disobedience brings discipline. So positionally, we're the house of the Lord, but we can be disciplined. In fact, we are more susceptible to discipline because of that relationship. Second part of the verse. Why is this happening? Because they have transgressed my covenant and rebelled against my law. And so the covenant and its brit and Torah there, synonymous terms, they have broken the covenant made at Sinai. And here's Israel's false cry, verse 2. Here's what Israel is crying out. They cry out to me, my God, we of Israel know you. My God, we know you. It's a claim of knowledge. It's a false claim. Because over and over and over again, Hosea has stated that Israel does not know God. That's the problem. It reminds me of Matthew 7:23. What did the Lord say in Matthew 23 to those who said, didn't we perform great miracles in your name? Yeah. He said, depart from me, I never knew you. I never knew you. Doug.
Before, Jesus said to the religious rulers, those whom you call your father, you don't know him.
Yes, John 8:54. Good cross-reference. John 8:54, write that down. Knowledge of God. And then we're not talking about strictly intellectual knowledge here. That's only part of it. So Israel's crying out, we know you, we know you, we know you. And God says, I never knew you. This is part of turning away from the Lord. Okay, the proof of this and the punishment that comes with it is found in verse 3. Israel has rejected the good. The enemy will pursue him. The proof is that Israel has turned its back on that which is good. That's the proof that Israel lacks the knowledge of God. And so the punishment will be the discipline, and it'll come from Assyria, pursued by the enemy. It'll come from Assyria. So that's the first call of the trumpet against the covenant breakers. The second call of the trumpet goes against illegitimate kings. Point B in your outline, first part of verse 4. They have set up kings, but not by me. They have appointed princes, but I did not know it. So these kings can gain control by assassination. See, there was no divine appointment, no prophetic sanction, as I mentioned earlier there. Most were illegitimate kings. Only two could be considered legitimate. Jeroboam the first in 1 Kings 11. Jeroboam the first in 1 Kings 11. And Jehu in 2 Kings 9. Jehu in 2 Kings 9. Jeroboam the first in 1 Kings 11. Jehu in 2 Kings 9. They were both evil kings, but they did have divine appointment and prophetic sanction to reign for a short time, to reign temporarily. So God's repeating a lot of his charges, and when God repeats something, we better pay attention to it. If he thinks it's important enough to say it twice or three times, we better pay attention to it. He's trying to communicate to us. And I know it can go right over our heads. You don't listen to me. I'm going to tell you a second time and a third time. Pay attention. Okay, the next trumpet call of judgment is against idolatry in verses 4 through 7. The sin in the first part of verse 4. Excuse me, the second part of verse 4. With their silver and gold they have made idols for themselves, that they might be cut off. So the sin is the idol worship. And the judgment comes in verses 5 through 7. He has rejected your calf, O Samaria, saying, my anger burns against them. How long will they be incapable of innocence? For from Israel is even this. You know, can you hear God's heart? From Israel is even this. A craftsman made it. So it is not God. Surely the calf of Samaria will be broken to pieces, for they sow the wind and they reap the whirlwind. The standing grain has no heads, it yields no grain. Should it yield, strangers would swallow it up. And so the golden calf, Samaria's golden calf, is going to be destroyed, God says. Now the golden calf, there were two golden calves set up. It wasn't set up in the capital city of Samaria, but because Samaria is the capital city, she bears responsibility for the golden calves. The golden calves were set up in Dan, one of the cities to the farthest north, and in Bethel to the south. There's the northern kingdom, Israel, here. So Jeroboam the first, I believe it was, set up these two golden calves because he didn't want people from the northern kingdom going down south into the southern kingdom and staying there. He thought it was politically risky. So you see where he set up the first golden calf? Right on the border. Right on the border. I don't want them to cross the border. So they can come down south, but then they can worship here. Now, what about the people up north? He set up a golden calf up here because it'd be closer. Hey, why go south? Just go north. So he's got these two golden calves strategically placed in order to keep the inhabitants of the northern kingdom in the northern kingdom, worshiping in pseudo-Jehovah worship, worshiping the Lord, so to speak, at these golden calves. Yes? Well, you know, the Samaritans, of course, at this time, in the first century, were a half-breed race that people had been brought in from by the Assyrians. They'd intermarried with the few Jewish people that were in the land. They were basically considered foreigners. But, you know, they had a temple. Archaeologists have uncovered the foundations of the temple up on Mount Gerizim there. And so we'll look into that more when those reports come out in detail. It'd be nice to see exactly what that temple is like. Apparently, it looks very much like the temple in Jerusalem. So there was false worship going on at Mount Gerizim, but it was Samaritan worship, like the Samaritans worship today as well. So it's related a little bit, but not quite the same thing. Was there a question over here? Bethel, house of God. See why God changed it to Beth-Aven? Yes, he changed the name of Bethel to Beth-Aven in Hosea, house of evil. Now, that's where the golden calves were set up. Now, when I was in Israel in 94, we went to Tel Dan up in the north, And this picture's a little dated, but archaeologists were reconstructing the temple and the altar that was there. This is the altar, and you see this form. They're going to put the stones in place on the existing foundations. And then there's a high place. This is the outside of the temple, and then you go up these steps to the holy place, and then there was a Holy of Holies at Dan. Now, in November last year when I was there, I was hoping to get there, and I was all primed to take some up-to-date photographs of what they've done here, but we didn't get in there. It was closed. We went on Shabbos, and we got there like at 4 o'clock, and they were supposed to be open for another hour at least, but they had closed the place down, probably because we were probably the only tour bus to show up. Anyway, this is the best I have for you. This is the high place at Dan. This is that false temple at Dan that archaeologists have uncovered. And again, dated picture. It's probably much more, you probably get a much better feel for what it was like 10 years later. But if we ever get there, if anyone gets there, take a picture for me, okay? So I can get an updated picture of the golden calf worship at Tel Dan. Okay. Now in verse 7, we saw that the land would not produce. He talks about in chapter 8, verse 7, that the standing grain has no heads, it yields no grain. That is one of the curses of the covenant, one of the curses of the Mosaic covenant. Deuteronomy 28, 17 and 18. Deuteronomy 28, 17 and 18. And Leviticus 26, 16 through 20. If you break my covenant and disobey me, I will bring discipline upon you. And in those chapters, the discipline gets more and more severe. If you don't listen to me, then I will do this. And if you don't listen to me, then I will do this. And then I will do this. And I will do this. And it gets worse and worse and worse and worse. So at the beginning of those chapters outlining the curses of the covenant, you get this curse that the land will not produce the way it's supposed to. And of course, how does that tie in? That ties into that drought we talked about at the earlier in the class here. God promises, I'm going to bring this tremendous severe drought upon the northern kingdom. Well, there, the land would not produce. The drought would be so bad that the fish in the Sea of Galilee would be dying. So this third trumpet calls against idolatry, against this golden calf worship. And one of the reasons why it was against the golden calf worship was because this worship stuck with Israel throughout the entire time of the northern kingdom. It stayed with Israel from the time Jeroboam the first put up the golden calf until the Assyrians destroyed the northern kingdom in 722. Now Israel would bring in other gods. They would bring in Baal and others like that, but then they discard Baal, they discard Astarte, but the golden calf always remained. It always remained. So God's promise is that eventually this thing is going to be eradicated. Now, just for your own information, I ran off a quick little article from the New Bible Dictionary on the golden calf. So you can add this to your notebook. It's just a little more information for you to read on your own. And if you get your... When you get your article, point one talks about the golden calf made at Mount Sinai, but then you'll see point two toward the bottom of the page. It deals with the history of the golden calf during the Northern Kingdom, during the time of the Northern Kingdom. And that's, of course, what we're dealing with primarily with the book of Hosea. Thanks, you guys, for handing this out for me. So read that article over at your leisure tonight before you go to bed, something like that. Okay, let's turn over to page 39 in your outline. We're dealing with the call of the trumpet of judgment, and now the fourth blast on the trumpet. Josh or Mac, is the word shofar there? Let's see. Yes, verse 8:1, is it a shofar? All right, good, I just want to make sure there, couldn't remember. Okay, the fourth sound of the shofar. Now, when I blow the shofar, it's the trumpet call of gathering, okay? Not the trumpet call of judgment. Okay, the fourth call of the shofar against the alliance with Assyria. Now, what's the political background of this trumpet blast? We saw that Israel, the northern kingdom, was like a silly dove, fluttering back and forth between Assyria and Egypt. You see, Israel saw that Assyria was growing in military and political might at this time. They saw that her influence was getting very strong, her power was getting very strong. And at one time, they made military alliances against Assyria in order to try and blunt her growing power. They made it first with the nation of Syria, S-Y-R-I-A, not Assyria, but Syria. They made an alliance with Syria, basically the same area that is Syria today, Damascus being the capital city, the same city. They made an alliance with Syria, and then they tried to get the southern kingdom of Judah to unite with them. And Judah would not do this. Judah would not go along with the scheme. And that's the background of Isaiah chapter 7 through 12. When you read Isaiah chapter 7 through 12, that's the background of that whole section. And so God is going to speak against these kind of alliances. Israel was making these alliances because they thought that these military and political moves could save them from the coming Assyrian domination. They could see it coming, but they thought they had the power to avert it. So that's the background for the trumpet against the alliance. We start with verse 8. Verse 8. Israel is swallowed up. They are now among the nations like a vessel in which no one delights. She's swallowed up among the nations. Again, a curse of the covenant. And it's Deuteronomy and Leviticus 26. Those are the two chapters that cover the curses, the blessings and curses of the Mosaic covenant. So Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus 26. It's not fun reading, but it is essential reading. So read those two chapters. They're parallel. They're not identical. But take a look at those curses of the covenant. One of them being dispersed among the nations. The reason? They tried to hire against Assyria in verse 9. For they have gone up to Assyria like a wild donkey all alone. Ephraim has hired lovers. Now the NASB says they have gone up to Assyria, and the idea is against. The idea is against Assyria there. They're not going up to be allied with Assyria, they're going up against Assyria. And they're described as a wild donkey. And the characteristics of a wild donkey are not positive characteristics. They're stubborn, they're independent, they're unsubmissive, they're untamable. So that's the word picture God uses to describe the northern kingdom. Stubborn, independent, unsubmissive, untamable. Totally consistent with their culture. Their culture is riddled with lies and truth, like that cake half turned. Their whole culture is unstable. The result comes in verse 10. Even though they hire allies among the nations, now I will gather them up, and they will begin to diminish because of the burden of the king of princes. So the result will be a decrease in numbers when they're destroyed by Assyria. So this won't help them. So alliances won't help you, Israel. The fourth trumpet of judgment comes against the altars of sin in verses 11 through 14. In verse 11, we see they had plenty of them. Since Ephraim has multiplied altars for sin, they have become altars of sinning for him. So this is a principle, an example of the principle, you reap what you sow. You reap what you sow. They planted altars, and so they became altars of sin. They made more and more altars for sin, and so that's what they experienced. The only legitimate altar was in Jerusalem. But you see, Israel had many. Like again, my photograph of the altar at Tel Dan. That's one of them, one of the more prominent ones. An altar of sin. I wonder if we ought to be rebuilding it. When they made these altars of sin, they had to discard the law of Moses in order to do it. Verse 12. Though I wrote for him 10,000 precepts of my law, they are regarded as a strange thing. Now, there's two ways this term in the NASB, 10,000 precepts, can be rendered. The NASB, of course, renders it 10,000 precepts. If that's the proper way to render it, it means it's a hyperbole, because there were actually only 613 commandments in the law. But it's the idea of, I could go on writing and writing and writing precepts forever, and they wouldn't recognize one of them as being good. So that's one way of rendering the thought. The other way of rendering the word is great things. And your Bible may translate it, even though I wrote great things for them in my law. They regarded it as a strange thing. So either way, the idea is still the same. No matter what, Israel considers the law of Moses a strange thing, something to be discarded. And so the result is that the sacrifices are unacceptable in verse 13. As for my sacrificial gifts, they sacrifice the flesh and eat it, but the Lord has taken no delight in them. So you see, Israel was careful to offer many sacrifices. See, there it is. There's that altar they're rebuilding. They offered multitudes of sacrifices upon that thing. They were careful to do that, but it wasn't in accordance with the Mosaic law. And so the sacrifices are unacceptable. The outward act has to have some proper content behind it. Or as we say in Hebrew, kavanah, the right intention. Has to have the right intention. So again, he's not denigrating the sacrificial system. He's just saying, let's have the right attitude and the right action. An attitude of love and obedience and faith, then the sacrifice is acceptable. And so judgment will come in verse 13. Now he will remember their iniquity and punish them for their sins. They will return to Egypt. Now, primarily here, Egypt is a symbol of captivity. The majority of the captivity will occur in Assyria. The vast majority of the people will end up in Assyria. But Egypt was the nation's first house of bondage. And so it's a symbol of the new enslavement, the new bondage. So primarily it's a symbol. But many of the northern kingdom did end up in Egypt. Jewish tradition tells us that a lot of them fled the drought and the famine predicted in chapter 4, verse 3. Remember that very severe drought and famine we looked at in chapter 4, verse 3, at the very beginning in our review. Many did go down to Egypt to get away from that. Israel's forgetfulness is brought out in chapter 14, verse 14, excuse me. For Israel has forgotten his maker and built palaces. They built palaces, they built temples. That became their hope and their security. These great monuments. That was their hope and security. That's what they gloried in. They didn't glory in the Lord. They gloried in these buildings. But then, in the second part of verse 14, there's a quick glance at the southern kingdom. In addition, God shows us that he is not overlooking Judah. And Judah has multiplied fortified cities. But I will send fire on its cities, that it may consume its palatial dwellings. And so Judah forgot his maker as well, and this was evidenced by the building of fortresses. Judah eventually trusted in military might rather than in God. And God says, I'm going to destroy those fortresses. And you see point B1 there. If you look in 2 Kings 18:13, look in that chapter, all 46 fortified cities in Judah were destroyed by Sennacherib. Point two, only Jerusalem survived in chapter 19. So mercy was shown on Judah. Remember, we saw that in chapter 1 and in chapter 4, that he would show mercy on Judah. He would not destroy Judah in the near future. Judah survived, Israel did not. But Judah was also disciplined. Israel was deported. So the Assyrians totally destroyed the northern kingdom and heavily devastated the southern kingdom. But the southern kingdom did survive and did exist from 722 to 586. So now Hosea, on page 40, directs our attention to the horrible discipline to come, Assyria. Now as we remember in our timeline here, he's looking ahead. He's looked at the pathetic present condition of the northern kingdom. Now he's talking primarily about the judgment that's going to be completed by 722, right in the middle of that section. So he talks about the coming exile in verses 1 through 9. Verse 1. Do not rejoice, O Israel, with exultation like the nations. For you have played the harlot, forsaking your God. You have loved harlot's earnings on every threshing floor. So the harlotry here is spiritual harlotry, and Israel is guilty of this adultery. And he talks about the joy that is related to the threshing floor. You see, a bountiful harvest was a joyful time. It was considered a time of God's favor, a sign of God's favor. But Israel has been thanking the idols. They've been thanking Baal. They've been thanking the golden calf. So they're guilty of spiritual adultery, spiritual harlotry. And in verse 2, their joy is going to be stripped away because the land will no longer produce. Verse 2, the threshing floor and wine vat and vine press will not feed them. The new wine will fail them. And that's the stripping of Israel mentioned in chapter 2. That's the drying up of the land mentioned chapter 4, verse 3. Curse of the Mosaic Covenant. If you turn away from me, the land will not produce. But a more severe curse of the Mosaic Covenant is the exile to Egypt and Assyria. In verses 3 through 6, point B there says 9, 3, you might add dash 6 there. That was left off, a typographical error. It's 9, 3 through 6, point 1. Is in verse 3, they won't dwell in the Lord's land. Verse 3, they will not remain in the Lord's land, but Ephraim will return to Egypt, and in Assyria they will eat unclean food. So notice who the owner of the land is. Who's the true owner of the land? It's the Lord. And God has granted the land to the Jewish people through the Abrahamic covenant. And you already have this chart. There are a few extra copies here if you don't have them. Remember, the Abrahamic covenant basically promised Israel three stipulations: a land promise, a national promise, and spiritual blessings. But discipline always comes with disobedience. And the land promise is expanded and developed in the land covenant of Deuteronomy 29 and 30. And the discipline, the most severe discipline of the land covenant, is dispersion out of the land. First it's local, then it's worldwide. And so he's promising a dispersion now out of the land. It said Ephraim returns to Egypt. And again, remember I stated that Jewish tradition states that many had already fled to Egypt to escape the drought and the famine. So there's a reference to Egypt. Some had gone to Egypt, but the second reference deals with eating unclean food in Assyria. The majority of the exiles will go to Assyria, and they will experience a fitting punishment. A fitting punishment for somebody who forsakes the Mosaic covenant. You're eating unclean food, unkosher food. There'll be a cessation of the festivals in verses 4 and 5. They will not pour out drink offerings of wine to the Lord. Their sacrifices will not please him. Their bread will be like mourner's bread. All who eat it will be defiled, for their bread will be for themselves alone. It will not enter the house of the Lord. What will you do on the day of the appointed festival and on the day of the feast of the Lord? So there'll be no wine offerings, no sacrifices, no solemn assemblies, no feast of the Lord. And again, this is not a reference to the legitimate temple in Jerusalem. Remember, they're observing the Mosaic law incorrectly. See, they've got temples. They got one at Tel Dan. There it is. They got one at Bethel. Okay? They were observing the Mosaic law incorrectly. They built up their own temples, and they used them for their worship. And they claimed they were worshiping the Lord. They celebrated Passover and Pentecost and tabernacles and all that. The new moons. So these false temples are going to be destroyed by Assyria. The people of the northern kingdom did not go to Jerusalem. At least the vast majority of them did not. I'm sure there were some. There some did migrate into Judah and live there. But the majority went to Bethel and to Dan. And so in verse 6, where is it here? Verse 6, for behold, they will go because of destruction. Egypt will gather them up. Memphis will bury them. Weeds will take over their treasure of silver. Thorns will be in their tents. They will find their burial in Egypt. They'll live and die in a foreign land. Now that reference to Memphis there. Memphis was one of the key capital cities of Egypt, and it was a site of a major burial ground. And so that's why God says, you'll be buried where the heathens bury their dead. You'll live in a foreign land. You'll die there. You'll be buried in their heathen burial grounds. Let's get through the middle of page 41. Point C at the top of page 41, he deals with the loss of spiritual discernment that Israel had. Verse 7. The days of punishment have come. The days of retribution have come. Let Israel know this. The prophet is a fool. The inspired man is demented. because of the grossness of their iniquity, and because of your hostility is so great. So he's saying, I'm not holding off the Assyrian judgment any longer. It's coming upon you. Now, Israel is going to gain some knowledge out of all this. She doesn't have knowledge of God, but she's going to gain some knowledge of God out of all this. They'll know that the false prophets are fools, and they'll know that their wickedness is great. So they'll finally recognize that all that come upon them is a judgment from the Lord. They will finally get that anyway. Verse 8, Ephraim was a watchman with my God, a prophet, yet the snare of a bird catcher is in all his ways, and there is only hostility in the house of his God. So Israel led. Israel took the forefront in the rebellion. They should have been, the northern kingdom should have been, as he says here, a watchman for God, a prophet, and yet they were leading in enmity and in evil. They were doing exactly the opposite of what they should have done. But that wasn't the worst sin. And the worst sin is the sin of Gibeon, verse 9. They have gone deep into depravity as in the days of Gibeah. He will remember their iniquity. He will punish their sins. Now, this sin of Gibeah was the most shocking sin of the period of the judges. This was a few hundred years earlier than Hosea's day. But the most shocking sin of that period was the sin of Gibeah. You see in point A, it was the sin with the Levite's concubine. It's covered in Judges 19 and 20, I believe. It involved three things, the sin of Gibeah. It involved rape. It involved homosexuality. It involved murder. The sin of Gibeah involved rape, homosexuality, and murder. All of it caused by rejecting God. But the point is, point B in your outline, now Israel, a few hundred years later, now Israel is just as sinful as the Benjaminites in Gibeah once were. You're just like them, Israel. You've sunk to that exact same depth. You were all shocked there. And so, the line is drawn. No more. Enough. Punishment is going to come. So read chapters 19 and 20 of Judges. You'll get shocked. It's not a pleasant picture. But the northern kingdom was at the same level. And that's when God brought judgment. Okay, let's go ahead and close in prayer. We'll pick up in the middle of chapter 9 there at verse 10 next week.